Good afternoon. Welcome to this edition of Radio Linguistica about the very interesting and actual subject of grammar of hate speech. So, please, the second slide. Well, we are in the pandemia, and there is also a second pandemia. Anti-Semitism and other forms of hate against minorities are on the rise. And during this pandemic, it spreads like the virus with the most diverse mutants. There is a plethora of conspiration theories which rarely lack anti-Semitic elements. I'm very happy to welcome here today the coordinator for on combating anti-Semitism and fostering Jewish life, Katharina von Schnurbein. Please say us a little bit about your post, how it was created, and what are your main tasks.
Thank you very much, Konrad. It's a pleasure to be here with you. So the European Commission created this post on a coordinate on combating anti-Semitism, fostering Jewish life, together with another post which was created as a coordinate on combating anti-Muslim hatred in December 2015, after we had seen a significant rise of anti-Semitism, of anti-Muslim hatred, and in particular also attacks on the Jewish community, and also the attacks on Charlie Hebdo and all the terrorist attacks that followed. So that was the background to say we need to address these issues now specifically. We need to have the possibility to liaise closely with the Jewish communities in order to know how the situation is, and then to use that as the basis for our policy making. And so my role is on the one side to closely liaise with the communities and to be in touch with them on a European level, but also national level, and to advise the political level with regards to policy suggestions, and then also the implementation of policies that are being decided. And over the past 5 years, we've been really looking at the different aspects of what it means to roll back anti-Semitism. And this year, we will adopt as European Commission the first ever EU strategy on combating anti-Semitism and fostering Jewish life.
Thank you very much. Well, perhaps before you can define how or see how to combat anti-Semitism, you have first to know what it is. Exactly, because there is controversies about, for example, criticism of Israel. Is it anti-Semitic, or when is it anti-Semitic? Also, could you a little bit define the object of your combat?
Indeed, you can't fight it if you can't define it. That was clear very quickly after we started to work more closely in this area. And we worked with the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, who was in the process of adopting a definition on anti-Semitism, which in a nutshell says anti-Semitism is hostilities towards Jews or also towards people who might not be Jewish, but the hatred can be portrayed on them as if they were Jewish. And then this definition, which has become the IRA definition and is quite well known now, it's non-legally binding, so it doesn't change the law or doesn't have an impact on law. But it has examples which spell out the ways contemporary anti-Semitism can be expressed today. And that is, unfortunately, with anti-Semitism, we have always added on different forms. We have the old Christian anti-Semitism, the racist anti-Semitism, the conspiracy myths, the idea that, you know, the Jewish superiority, that Jews control the world, the media, the banks, and that racist anti-Semitism that led up to the Shoah, to the Holocaust. And once after the Holocaust, we could have thought that anti-Semitism finally was conquered or overcome. Unfortunately, we developed new forms of anti-Semitism, and one is related to Holocaust denial and distortion that we have seen on the rise, including during the COVID pandemic. The other form is Israel-related anti-Semitism. So when hatred towards Jews is being projected on the state of Israel, or if the Jews in Europe, for example, who are European citizens, are being held accountable for the actions of the Israeli government. So all of these forms are covered by this definition. And given that it's non-legally binding, we see it as a very useful educational tool to inform lawmakers, but also law enforcement agencies, educators, teachers, the media, the general public about various forms of anti-Semitism, because you need to see it in order to address it.
Thank you very much. But your job title has not only this, let's say, negative part, combating something, combating anti-Semitism, but also a positive one, of fostering Jewish life. Could you tell us a little bit more about this part of your tasks?
Yes, I think it's very important to recognize the rich Jewish history that we have, and every European country has Jewish history, which of course has been to a large extent wiped out during the Holocaust, and has in different forms been revitalized since then. But still the number of Jews living in Europe today is significantly lower than it was before the Second World War. And I think it's important to understand the richness of diversity, of Jewish diversity, also understand the contribution that the Jewish community has made through the last 2000 years that it's been in Europe to the development of European culture and European economy and politics, and to recognize that, and then also to see how diverse Jewish life is in Europe today, and that you have, you know, politically, the from the right wing to the left wing, you have religious, you have secular, you have the different shades of the religious streams that there are. So it's a very diverse and colorful community, and because they are relatively small in size, we don't necessarily know about this. So we think that given that the European Union was one or was an outcome also from the fact that we said never again after the Holocaust, there is a certain responsibility also to ensure that Jewish life can flourish in Europe today again. So this is the reasoning behind saying fostering Jewish life is an aspect also of my responsibilities.
Thank you very much. Well, we are not far from Easter, and we have chosen here a photo of a very rich decorated table with the whole family around. Perhaps you could explain what this means.
Yes, I mean, Easter is was at the time of the Jewish Pesach festivities in Jerusalem at the time, and what you see is a seder, the eve of the Pesach, because the Jewish holidays start at sunset and then end at the sunset of the next day, and you see the different herbs that are being eaten that have a various symbols of Moses taking the Jews from slavery into freedom out of Egypt. And this is celebrated every year and usually is around Easter this year. It starts actually tomorrow evening, and Easter is 1 week away. And then you see, for example, also in the middle of this round table, the matzot, so the bread, the unleavened bread, symbolizing that the Jews had to leave Egypt so quickly that they didn't have time to let the bread rise, and therefore it's flat. So just a few examples, but I think, you know, even for a Christian religion, it's interesting to know something about Jewish traditions and religious traditions in order to better understand also the Christian religion. That's what I find myself not being Jewish.
Thank you. Well, let's come back to the less pleasant part of our the topic today on, hate speech. And, there is a big controversy today around the facts. What is free speech or freedom or legally granted freedom of speech? And what is hate speech? And there is a blurred zone where it's sometimes difficult to say, is this still criticism, which is legally protected, or is it already criminal hate speech? So we'll try to find some more, let's say, objective criteria to define hate speech, or at least to show some ways to research on this phenomenon. And therefore, I welcome Professor Natalia Knobloch from Michigan. Thank you very much for joining us. She is a specialist in analyzing the linguistic forms or the linguistics patterns of hate speech. Please, could you describe a little bit what you are doing, what you are researching in?
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. And it was very interesting to hear the first part of the presentation. So the question about the fuzziness of the borders between free speech and hate speech is a very serious question. And there are multiple definitions of hate speech. I like the European Commission the best, actually, because it talks about the harm that is intended in the hate speech, which is illegal. There are differences of understanding of the concept of hate speech between different cultures and different countries. So you are aware of the differences between, let's say, European approach to hate speech and American approach to hate speech. So one of the difficulties in hateful, aggressive, dehumanizing, and othering discourse is its complexity, right? So one of the difficult issues that we have to deal with is the fact that almost anything language related can be used in multiple ways. The analogy can be with, let's say, a rock, right? We can use it to pave the road, or we can hit a person on the head with it. And one use is, of course, fine, and the other is definitely not. Or a knife can be used to cook dinner, or it can be used to kill a person. So words can be kind of those kind of tools. They can be used for good, and they can be used for evil. And so it is very difficult to come up with definite ways to define this. And so there are attempts. And in natural language processing, there are attempts, they have been going on for several decades already, that are aimed at automatic identification of hate speech in online communication. Because hateful and aggressive discourse is hateful and aggressive, it's not acceptable in official communication. So it is more often found in informal communication. So it's either oral discourse or social media and informal communication on the internet. So there are attempts to find criteria where the computer could identify it right away. And so people came to the conclusion that it's extremely difficult. And so one of the things that we found promising is to use corpus linguistic approaches where there are where there is attention to collocation and to not just identification of a problematic word, but attention to what company is this word in. So an example of what a collocation is would be, you know, to give a simple example, is in English, people do say fast train or fast food, but people don't really say quick train and quick food. On the other hand, quick shower or quick meal are common, but fast shower, fast meal are not used. So we're not talking about grammatical rule that an adjective is used or not used with a noun. We're talking about patterns that are observed in natural conversation. And so some of the things that people have been doing is looking at collocations, because you can use a supposedly innocent word, but use it in a negative context. And that could be very hurtful and very aggressive. Or you can use a slur and use it as a joke, right? We all can criticize people for using those kind of jokes, right? And say, no, it's not funny. But we know that people still do that. And what can we do about this? So those are some of the issues that are related to identification of hateful and aggressive discourse.
Well, most of our audience are linguists, but perhaps you could nevertheless, for the other ones, define a little bit what is a corpus, and perhaps you have a nice example on a corpus you were researching it.
Okay, well, corpus linguistics is a branch of linguistic science that relies heavily on large bodies of text, large in the sense of several billion words. Okay, so let's say British National Corpus. I can't off the top of my head to give you the size, but it's several billion words. And with the computer technology, it became possible to accumulate bodies of text that are this big. And then it also became possible to use automatic searches and statistical analysis of words. And that's when we can say that, let's say, fast train is used fairly common, but quick train is not used, even though fast and quick are synonyms. So those examples would be kind of an illustration of what corpus linguistics does.
And especially in your field, so analyzing corpora for hate speech, so could you give us an example?
Well, some of my research involved analysis of Facebook conversations on the official Facebook page of then candidate, not even president, but candidate Trump. And so after he announced that he was proposing the Muslim ban, this announcement generated a huge conversation on his Facebook page. Within days, there were 15,000 or 17,000 comments, and each comment became a thread, you know, that had comments, replies to replies. So there were several million words in that collection, and I was able to collect the comments. So it wasn't Trump's speech. It wasn't what he actually said. It was people were saying for his proposal or against that. And so some of the things that came up were lexical, right? So there were some words that we could analyze as recurring and coming up more and more very often as kind of dominant themes there. But one of the interesting things that kind of pushed me in the grammar direction was the usage of the verb must. And that is supposedly a grammatical feature. I can give you an example that the verb must can be used in two different senses. So one I can kind of label as obligation. You must study, right? A mother can tell the child, you must make your bed or something like that. So one of the prototypical uses of the verb must is obligation. Another one is, I call it kind of guess, right? For example, if we say, they're late, they should be here, but they're not, they must be stuck in traffic. In this case, we're not talking about obligation. Nobody has a duty to be stuck in traffic. We're just making a guess, trying to explain why this person is not here. Or this is fairly common also. But in analysis of pro-Trump and anti-Trump comments, I noticed that pro-Trump people used must as obligation several times more often than the guess sense. But anti-Trump people were using the guess sense several times more often than the duty. And so, I mean, anyone can interpret it however they want, right? What's your guess? You know, what does it tell you about the crowd that says, oh, we must stop them? Excuse me. They must have, I don't know, their fingerprints taken at the border. They were talking about themselves as if they're in control of that other group and they had the right to decide and to dictate to them. While the other group was more likely to say something like, Second World War veterans must be turning in their grave. Right, it's not an obligation. It's kind of a metaphor that this is so outrageous that people who fought against fascism would have been outraged had they witnessed this proposal to ban a certain group of people. So those were some of the things that I have been working with. And currently, this project serves as an inspiration for a book project that I'm working on. It's under contract with Cambridge University Press, and we are hoping that it comes out at the end of this year, possibly beginning of 2022. The provisional title is Grammar of Hate. And so it looks at grammatical morphosyntactic features of hateful, dehumanizing, and aggressive discourse. So
please inform me when the book comes out, and then we will acquire it for our library here in the commission. I just wanted to add we had Trump already in our radio emission, not in person, but in the person of his French translator, who wrote a book, La Langue de Trump, Bérangère Guénon. I don't know, perhaps you know this book, or yes, of course. And also very interesting insights in the special language of this president. Well, you do very interesting, nice research on this subject, but are there perhaps already practical applications, for example? Linguists ask at court, for example, court proceedings or so, experts.
Well, absolutely. There are forensic linguists who do amazing things. One of them is John Baugh, and I was lucky to listen to a live lecture once. And so he gets called to court very often and testifies, helps the jury make an informed decision of whether or not there was discrimination. So one of the things that Dr. Baugh has been working is housing discrimination. The story that started it involved him himself, because he happens to be Black, and he was looking for housing and was denied because people spotted African-American accent over the phone. And so he then developed a scientifically designed project where he would call the advertisements for apartments or houses for rent. And because he's perfectly fluent in African American English, white American English, and Chicano English, he would start his conversation with either Black English and say, I'm looking for this apartment. Can I please have an appointment to have a look? And then he would be denied. And he would call the same number and ask the same questions in his prep school, so-called white English, right? Standard American English. And he would be given the showing of the same property. And it happened over and over, so he could demonstrate that there was a systemic discrimination against speakers of non-standard American Englishes. And so those are some of the things that he has been invited to testify about several times. And he has developed a very good technique when he makes the jury listen to, let's say, male and female voices. Can you identify who is male, who is female? And say, sure. And then they say, can you tell a child from an adult when they speak? And they can, of course. And then the person who is being on trial for possibly prejudice, discrimination, housing discrimination, and the person claims that, no, I could not tell if it was Black English or standard English, or it was Chicano English or standard English. And by then, after listening to several samples and being able to identify everything, the jury just rolls their eyes and kind of, yeah, right, you can. Everybody can, and now you're pretending that you cannot. And so this has been a very successful and effective technique for, let's say, like housing discrimination, accent discrimination.
Extremely interesting, this practical use of your research, and we are looking forward, of course, to your book. Please inform us when it will be published. Thank you very much. I will come back to Katharina a little bit, ask her you about some practical criteria on this in this definition of anti-Semitism.
Well, first of all, I also would like to say, I mean, I found what Natalia just explained fascinating and really very enriching. Myself, I'm a linguist, not a linguist, but I've done literature. So, you know, but this is really, really impressive. So, yes, with regards to anti-Semitism and hate speech or free speech in that context. So first of all, we have, as Natalia also said, we have legislation in Europe that sets limits to free speech, and that's speech that is inciting to hatred and violence. And when that is the case, it is illegal. And on that basis, for example, the European Commission agreed with the big IT companies, the big social platforms in 2016, a voluntary code of conduct whereby they take down illegal hate speech according to this legislation within 24 hours when it's flagged to them. And so we have seen through this process a responsabilization of the platforms acknowledging that they have a responsibility in addressing hate speech. And it's not only a question of the users or a question of the state, because of course the state has a responsibility as well when it comes to prosecuting hate speech online, just as it would have offline. With anti-Semitism, it's difficult, and I think a lot of what Natalia said is also relevant in the sense that the context matters, and in particular in the gray areas. So of course there is clear, when it's clear incitement to hatred and violence, you know, then it's clear also with regards to takedowns, and it's not infringing on free speech. But when it is about Israel-related anti-Semitism, for example, you know, this IRA definition itself says criticism of Israel like that leveled at any other country cannot be considered anti-Semitism. So it's not trying to limit criticism of the government of Israel. Where the red line is crossed is when it's about the existence of the state of Israel. You know, so seeing Israel as a racist endeavor, and therefore it shouldn't even exist, or talking about wiping Israel off the map. It's very difficult to do that without killing people. So, you know, so it's, I think that this is, it's, again, it's these kind of semantics, but you need the context in order to understand where this line is crossed. And that's why it's also so controversial, because some people perceive something that they say with regards, for example, you know, to Jews in Europe, simply as expressing their own opinion with regards to Israel. But it can be perceived by the person that is, for example, you know, I don't know, tell your prime minister not to violate human rights all the time. You know, they say, I'm going to Israel, and this is the reaction. So it can be, you know, it's not hate speech. It's not, you know, it's not illegal. But for the person that feels French or feels German and sees themselves as German, it's something where they say, wait a minute, what do I have to do with the Prime Minister of Israel? You know, so this, I think, is the challenge to say also that with regards to anti-Semitism and other forms of hatred, the threshold of illegal speech is a very high one, and rightly so, because we have court legislation which says, you know, that speech can offend, can shock, and so on. So that's all part of free speech. But we also have to be aware that it can still be harmful, and it can still be perceived as something infringing on my own identity and my own freedom. And that's, I think, the challenge, to acknowledge this, that things that that are being said, they are not necessarily, they don't necessarily have to be illegal, but they can still be perceived as anti-Semitic, or they can still be anti-Semitic.
Well, thank you very much. We have come to the end of our edition of Radio Linguistica. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you very much for these very interesting, impressive contributions. And well, we have to continue the combat. We have to continue the research. You have shown some examples on which track this combat can continue. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
It's been a pleasure.
We should have a follow-up on how to which strategies were the most effective. I'm very interested in Katarina's work.
Of course, yes. Well, thank you very much, and we continue.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye.